Listening to Radio Statler with the classic. Oh, you're listening to Radio Statler, and it's time to chat about classic consoles. My name is A-Freak. I am with here with Rodent and Maxim. Say hello.
Hey, A-Freak. This is Rodent.
Hey guys. This is Maxim.
So somehow we're going to put this show together half-assedly. I think most of us are on IRC right now, and we're just going to chit chat about consoles that I guess require cartridges and not this what's this shitty disc technology or whatever.
Oh, so the old school.
Yeah, console. We're talking stuff that doesn't require mechanical parts except for a spring.
Okay, so like the original Nintendo.
Yeah, the Nintendo, the Super Nintendo. Maybe you might actually touch one CD console. I don't know, 3DO. Anyone like the 3DO?
I never had one. I remember them, but I never had one.
I used to have one of those original Atari ones with the cartridges, and I think I've seen one out there in the vintage booth. Yeah, I used to have one of those.
Those guys are pretty awesome, actually, having some sort of stuff.
I remember Space Invaders was a favorite game.
The arcade version was way better.
I miss the music to that stuff.
Well, instead of having this, this orchestrated crap that we have today. Oh, what's this here?
Do we have a caller?
Oh, just don't kill that one. Okay.
All right. We do have a call-in line. We'll get the number for you here.
It's 212-888-9033. Maxim, what sort of video game consoles have you had growing up before what you have today? Do you have anything?
Actually, I haven't really been that much of a gamer. I grew up with the Commodore 64, and obviously that had a lot of games on it. Before that it was that Atari console, but the Commodore 64, I actually used to program assembler, so I kind of stopped playing once I got the
Commodore.
That was
Commodore. The 6502, right?
With the SID chip and all that stuff.
Oh, and we also have a DS Mio. Oh my god. I guess you should put on a pair of headphones and introduce yourself. Oh,
Radio Statler 212-888-9033. And Audio Smeal is going to join us. He's got some, he made his own console.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some headphones there he can
let me just get
plug in right
headphones.
There.
So, Ronan, what did you have as growing up with the
I had the original Nintendo. And I remember as a kid, though, as well, friends of mine having the original Atari. And played a lot of those. And then my first experience of it, of my very own, was my Commodore VIC-20. Mm. And I actually used that more for cartridges that I'd buy to play games. And then I also had the tape.
Video game consoles and not
in
side pocket?
Oh, my God.
Sit down.
So it also had a cassette drive.
That's
that
right.
I'd buy tapes and program stuff on it and then also play games with it. So I did that quite a bit, but... So for me, it was the original Nintendo and my Commodore VIC-20 that I played the most out of.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of cartridges for my VIC-20.
Yeah, and tapes, they're a nice relic, but I am glad we have moved on because the slow data feed and the potential to corrupt.
Yeah.
Not fun.
Yeah, I'd have to load the tapes several times.
Yeah.
I'll just keep in mind, that mic is weak. You guys can choke up on that real
hard.
Okay,
like that? Okay.
Yeah, so...
I remember having a C64. I didn't actually have any cartridges, but I did actually have the floppy drive and the tape drive, and that was an interesting experience having to go through, having to flip the goddamn tape after loading up the game, and then you find out the damn tape after 5 minutes is busted anyway.
Right, or certain games you like load it at night, and in the morning you can play it.
Oh.
I started out at a much later age. I was in the era of 3 1/4-inch discs. Started out with the Atari ST, a big stack of floppies with a fun game.
68K, man.
Yeah. It was a great system, actually. There was tons of games published for the Atari ST.
It's funny, a lot of the consoles back then used the 68K. It was like, I think I could think of about 6 or 7, like the Atari Jaguar for one day used what, the 68060.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, even the Sega Genesis used like a 16-bit 68000, right? So.
Right.
Besides having the Atari ST, did you have anything like console-wise? Like, did you have a Genesis or?
I started out on the original NES.
Okay,
I was still young really back then. Normal Christmas cycle, for games. And,
new console, new Christmas
something fun to do in the suburbs of Chicago, especially during the wintertime.
I understand your pain.
But very mainstream NES, SNES, Sega Genesis.
How about your side pocket?
Let's see. Thank God we're talking about consoles, not first games, because I can't remember first games. But, I remember my uncle had Atari 2600 in his house. And I personally, myself, I also had an Atari ST and then later on a Commodore 64. My first console, it's weird, I had an NES, but it was my friend's NES because I couldn't afford it yet. The first one I could actually afford was the successor, the SNES and the
Which
Genesis.
Which was the best fucking console ever.
Yeah, that was the best console war also ever.
Yeah.
It's nice that, you know, the competition, we really got good games out of it as opposed to sort of this market sharing thing now.
It's really sick, though. I collect consoles, so I have about, I think, about 16 or 17 consoles in my possession now. And, you know, my fiance, she kind of gets bothered every time I consider buying another one. But I have a bit of a sick obsession with the Super Nintendo. And I actually have about four or five Super Nintendos, and they're all different models.
Wow.
And, like, you know, one that's Japanese, one that I'm using to build, like, an adapter for LCD and all this sort of thing. And, like, I don't know. I've never been as interested in other consoles, but I collect them. Like, you know, I mentioned a 3DO earlier. I do have that.
Awesome.
Right? Yeah.
Finally, another person that has that.
You have a 3DO?
Yes.
Which one do you have, actually? Because there are, like, several models.
Yeah, I have that, the I can't remember the model name, but it's the more compact one where you actually had a slot tray that slid out.
Okay, was it the Panasonic FZ01?
Yes.
Yes.
That one.
Yeah, that's the most common one, actually. The 3DO was probably the neatest console in terms of how it managed the controllers themselves, because
right.
you daisy-chain them. So
yeah.
Which was kind of a cool concept, because then you wouldn't have, like, so many freaking wires going across your living room floor.
You also had the headphone jack plugged directly in the controller, if I remember.
Does it actually work on all games?
It works on mine.
Well, I've never tried that. I never had a reason to, so...
Yeah.
So... I actually don't know where we're going to go with this whole little topic here, actually, because Bunny on IRC asked me months ago to actually do a talk on Radio Statler, and the one thing that I am passionate about is actually old video game consoles, so I grabbed a few people who may have some sort of inkling of something maybe more or less related, so... I don't know where we could start off, but maybe we could talk about your pinball machine, Hadeus Neil.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I have a huge nostalgia for video games, but I am stuck in the NES era. I stopped buying consoles
good
after
era
the
to
Sega
be stuck
Genesis.
In.
What's that?
It's a good era to be stuck in.
Yeah,
yes.
I have probably 1,000 NES ROMs that I just pick through anytime I'm bored, and I have a little Japanese rip-off emulator that, you know, has like 16 hours worth of battery.
Not the Pandora.
Yeah, I think you showed it to us. A little black. It was like $100 or something.
It was white. It cost about $70 now. You can get it, I think, on Slick Deals.
Was this on Deal Extreme as well?
I believe so.
It's
too.
Like a it's like a Chinese PSP knockoff with like emulators to run like a ton of games.
Yeah, it has the look of an NES controller, very square. But it's a great little platform because it emulates like five different consoles and plays video and MP3s and all that.
And it does it in native. Well, I would say quote unquote native speed, right?
It does very well. It has some trouble with it can run Sega games, but it has a little trouble with games like Sonic, which are real high speed.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, the model that you're mentioning, is that the model that does the Neo Geo?
Yes.
Yeah.
It
okay.
Does
so then
Neo
I know
Geo
what you're
support.
Talking. Okay.
Yeah.
How is Neo Geo? Because my understanding, when the Neo Geo was first emulated, it was a real pain in the ass due to the way it handled it.
I wish I could tell you, but I've never had an experience with a Neo Geo game, so I have not.
You
loaded
should be
any
giving King of Fighters a try or Metal Slug.
Yeah.
The cool thing about the Neo Geo, for those who don't know, the Neo Geo is actually the longest lasting cartridge console, or even arcade actually system, because I think it was from like 92 to 2003, and the reason why it lasted so long is on each cartridge the RAM was on it. So you would have a minimal amount of RAM on the actual system itself, but you were able to expand on the memory by placing in the cartridge, which of course made it grotesquely expensive. You're paying like $200, $300 for the cartridge after you paid $200, $300 for the cartridge, the console itself. It actually made it, that, I think that was the main reason why emulating was a pain in the ass, because you know you had to basically set it up so each game had a different memory.
It was also the high specs level that came out. It was hard to balance, like, because you had so much graphic data and music data on these cartridges. And what's very interesting is the reason why it's set up like that is because it was originally designed as an arcade thing. Because before that, each arcade board was completely unique to itself. And so they capitalized, SNK capitalized that, why don't we just make them really advanced cartridges so that way they can actually use the same arcade machine but switch out the games. And then when they saw the home console market, they basically made it so it's home console-like because they already had the cartridge plugs in and shipped it out.
And it's kind of funny though. The arcade cartridges are actually much cheaper than the home cartridges. So what a lot of people do now is they actually go and buy the arcade boards, and then they actually just they basically create a case or something around the board, and just play off of that. I don't know if I'd want to have a 2 by 2 foot by 1 foot console, because if I was going to do that, I'd get an Xbox, but. You know,
or PS3.
So yeah, I actually do miss the arcades. Their arcades are a dying breed. You know, I don't know what's New York City's arcade scene like.
It's pretty dismal. You can go to a couple of bars that have some skee ball and a couple of pinball and arcade machines. There's a Dave and Buster's, which is all really contemporary gaming, geared towards adults.
And in Maya, New Jersey, basically only find them by the shore near boardwalks. Mm-hmm. What's sad was in my dreary hometown of Rutherford, they actually used to have this really huge arcade game symposium there with, you know, Lost World Light Gun Shooter and, like, old, you know, 2D racing games. And they actually plowed that down for more parking space. So what's weird is I can actually walk around the parking space and tell you where each arcade machine was.
Speaking of boardwalks, if you're in New York City, it's a good idea to go by Coney Island and just play some of the games that they have out. There's a bunch of arcades out there. Just for nostalgia's sake, I think when I first came here, I went to Coney Island, played some skee ball, took my tickets home, just so I
could
say.
You take the subway out there, I would take it, hey?
Yeah.
Awesome.
It takes a little while, but it's definitely worth a trip.
There used to be a chain of arcades, arcadiums. I don't know what you call it. What do you call an arcade? Like, you just call it the arcade, don't you?
Yeah.
There's no real term, plural.
Is that the Canadian vernacular?
Yeah, I don't know. Arcadian, well, there's Stadium Arcadian by Red Hot Chili Peppers, right? So...
The only arcades that I get to see regularly are ones at movie theaters.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
And some of them, like a couple in Vegas, actually have some pretty old school games in there. Like they even had like an ancient Street Fighter.
Oh yeah, it's Circus has a great little arcade.
Circus one has or an awesome two arcade.
Yeah, because one is a horrible game.
Yeah, I know. Because you said ancient, two. So okay,
no,
yeah.
It was old, but it
not
wasn't
that old.
A very very old one.
Out in Vegas, you guys also have the Pinball Museum.
And that is amazing how much power they have to run into that joint just to run, like, you know, a couple thousand pinball games. Yeah. But still, it's a lot of power. And very old games, and they keep them in great condition. They recondition them. And
they have a lot of the classic Sega ones from the 70s? I think that's where Sega started off.
The whole era.
Yeah, like the SG-100, things like that.
Yeah. Arcades in Canada are pretty much going bye-bye. There used to be a whole chain of them called Playdium, and they used to pretty much existed in, like, you know, most of the major cities. But what's really killed them off, at least where I'm from, in Vancouver, is that in order to have an arcade machine in your shop and in order to charge for it, so you can have an arcade machine and not charge for it, that's fine. But if you want to charge for an arcade machine, you actually have to get a license and I think it was like a $120 a year license. So if you're only charging, you know, 25, 50 cents or a dollar for a game, and, you know, you only get maybe about, you know, 5 or 6 plays out of a month, and
we'll
you multiply
that
over the year, you're not going to make that money back. So a lot of these laundromats and convenience stores and, you know, gas stations, they've gotten rid of these arcade machines because it's just simply not profitable anymore to actually run them.
The cabinet that I brought today to Hope is essentially a kind of a blank slate for emulation. I designed it as a pinball machine about 1/3 scale because I'd seen some commercial versions of it. I believe the biggest commercial version is called Ultra Pin. It uses a very large HDTV screen for the play field and for the back glass. My particular pinball machine has typical arcade controls. The flipper buttons have solenoids connected to them for good feedback, good realistic experience with pinball.
I remember playing with that, it did feel really spot on there.
The shooter works as a normal shooter would. It has 5 levels of responsiveness, which is all controlled through an Arduino. There's a joystick and A-B buttons on the top, so you can load up Pac-Man or anything you want to play normal games. There aren't a lot of cabinets that are geared towards pinball, even though software like PinMame and MAME with pinball ROMs are designed to run on those cabinets. They're just not set up for good, realistic pinball experience. Mm-hmm. And if anyone is here at Hope, they can come see it over here in the art space near Radio Statler. I'm also going to give a talk on it today at about 1 p.m. You guys can come see it in the... I want to call it the Tornado Room, but it's where all the performances are occurring here at Hope. Yeah.
Now, it was mentioned on IRC here by Earl Grey here that the arcades in the United Kingdom are just about dead. And what did he have to say? I'm just wondering, actually, Maxim, since you're from Switzerland, is there any sort of arcade scenes there?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. I cannot think of a place, you know, that used to be like back in the 80s or something where you can just go in and play like that.
I remember as a kid, I was always be begging my parents for a quarter or something like that. Just, you know, hey, Mom, Dad, you know, hey, there's an arcade. You know, even to go camping, you would go to a campground and it would have an arcade there. Like, the only time I think I've seen an arcade that's, you know, that's an arcade is usually it's attached to, like, a go-kart track or a paintball place.
Or bowling alley.
Or bowling alley, right. Yeah.
And actually, I think, when like, once in a while they have, like, fairs, like town fests or something, and then they would bring in an arcade for that. But I can't think of any, like, permanent places.
I do notice that, though, in a lot of areas where there's a high concentration of East Asians, however, like, such as, you know, Chinese, Korean, or Japanese, there's actually a lot of arcade machines. There's a part of Vancouver called Richmond, which is very much, I would say, East Hong Kong at this point. And there's tons of these arcades, but they're always joined up with those land gaming places. So the land gaming places overwhelm the arcades, but you know, they'll bring in all these old arcade machines over from Japan. So I don't know, is that the same over here with the land gaming places, or is it just pretty much if you see a land gaming place, it's just land gaming? Do you see that at all here, or?
Well, I have not seen a land gaming shop in New York. I think they died off with the .com boom, if they ever existed here at all.
Heading off?
Yeah, I'm going to go get a beer.
Okay.
So no, that's pretty rare. I mean, we do have places where you can go and play old school games. Just kind of got to dig for them here.
I think what's becoming more commonplace is that it's more turning into I wouldn't say a club, but more of a it's way more private these days. Like there's one guy, I think he's in South Carolina, and he was in some, for the life of me, I can't remember where it was published, but he had this incredible warehouse inside of his on his property that just had nothing but arcade machines, and he just decked it out to look like a classic, you know, maybe a little bit more modernist nostalgic kind of arcade little setup. And you know, I think that's what it's become, is everyone's just rescuing these machines and just restoring them. Like in our case at Vancouver Hackspace, we actually have a arcade machine. It's one of those NFL Blitz machines.
Mm.
And we're not going to use it for anything. We're just going to remove it and turn it to MAME. And I think that's what's happening with a lot of these arcade machines. It's just becoming MAME cabinets.
It's interesting because, you know, when you think about it, the original whole thing was they were very mass-produced. It was kind of thrown out there. So it's kind of interesting that after a period of time, something that we just took for granted as a piece of consumerism actually becomes a relic and a piece of history.
It does.
Yeah.
And El Cassette here just said that he actually lives in Richmond and he has to go see the arcades. It's actually a number 3 road. There's one called Rush, which I think is across from Johan Center. So if you're there, go there and check it out. And Megatron here says Land Gaming Center in Birmingham is fun. You know, if you guys want to talk about this, if you guys are actually in the area, you guys can call into 212-888-9033 and we'll take your call if you want to talk about arcades in your neighborhood or your city or your experiences in general of classic gaming. We would love to hear from you guys.
You know, I don't think the move to MAME is such a bad thing, because I think MAME cabinets, dedicated cabinets, are getting popular and people are building them on their own and having a real legitimate arcade experience just in their own homes. I know kids no longer go out and play with their parents, you know, pocket change to get out of the house. They're stuck inside
with their own credit cards now.
Yeah,
on the Facebooks and you know, playing their Wiis. Unfortunately, there's no reason to leave the house anymore, and no way to monetize that market anymore. But I think arcade gaming is being well preserved with the emulation community.
Yeah, like I actually look at the Wii as a perfect example of where the emulation community's gone right. Like in my case, yeah. I have a modified Wii that will load up. I have every Super Nintendo game, for instance, every Genesis game on an external hard drive hooked up to it, and it works perfectly because the controller is effectively the
NES control if you hold it on the side. We call it classic mode.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and it works perfectly. And I think the Wii is probably the best console if you're an emulator fan, with a couple exceptions like the Nintendo 64, and I find the Neo Geo is a little bit iffy on it, but for everything else, it works excellent, to say the least. Mm-hmm. You've been pretty quiet there, right?
Yeah.
water.
Should we take some calls, or how does that
work? Yeah, actually, well, we put the number out, and I'm surprised that nobody has called. Like, I was hoping this Elkaset guy would call in, actually, to say thank you.
So how does that work? They just call in, and they're on the air?
Yeah, well, we actually have a little... I think we could just hit a button on this laptop here, and we can just accept your call, so...
We are in control. Can maybe go back to the topic of like classic consoles, and if I could bring up a topic,
sure.
How about we all go around and say, because we can talk about how awesome classic gaming was, but what was, like, in our opinion, like the worst console that came out during, like, I would even include like early CD consoles, like, you know,
Sega CD wasn't that bad though.
It wasn't.
I honestly would say the worst console ever, and it is not really much of a console, really, more than a semi-portable, was actually the Virtual Boy. I honestly hate that.
I thought
that
was going to bring that up.
Like, I want to say that, you know, the Atari, well, not the 5200. No, the 5200 with that horrible joystick, right? It felt stiff as...
That never worked.
That never worked. but it looked like it was a fucking a cell phone, I swear to God.
And
it
has a built-in closet for no reason.
Exactly. Like, you could put your Mountain Dew or where the hell you drank back then, right?
Yeah. Cheetos.
What is the worst console?
Ironically, I'm user Virtual Boy, and I think, like, as a design for a console, because, you know, burns your eyes after a while, you could use that for, like, a new Saul movie, you know, just play it for 5 hours. It actually had a decent library. Ironically, if I had to pick, onto your schedule, you know, Sega CD was, like, a failed attempt. It wasn't horrible. It was just a failed attempt. I would actually classify the 32X just because of the way it was completely handled by Sega. I think that broke a lot of Sega's ground when they did that.
It was released in that 6 months before. It was the 6 months before the Saturn came out. And then shortly after the Saturn came out, it's like, oh no, we're working on a new console, which is the Dreamcast, which was both the Saturn and the Dreamcast were great consoles.
Yeah.
But because of Sega being retarded with their marketing... Right. They both flopped.
And basically, it's like a loss of confidence. It's basically they had the market share, and they told everyone we had no idea what we're doing at the top. Yeah.
I think the failure of the Sega CD was with the format change. I don't think people really understood the idea of switching away from their cartridges. But why do I need to replace all my games with this new format? I think it was a plus to note
that with all these add-ons, unlike today where they, you know, like USB feeds off its own power, if you bought an add-on, most add-ons, even in Japan, had to have their own power adapter.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. I'm fortunate. With my Sega CD, I have the Sega CDX, which is the all-in-one unit, which actually was a Genesis. You can sort of put a 32X on it, but it's funny with the 32X being the worst, in your opinion, because... From a technical standpoint, it actually did a lot of good for the Genesis, but it's just that it just sucked because it was not marketed.
In terms of rough graphics, it was decent. You know, Saturn was obviously a bigger leap. The sad thing about it was that they had a lot in graphics, but they did little with sound. Like, for example, if you play Doom on the 32X and you play Doom on the NES, well, obviously the 32X one looked better because of the amazing sound chip that, ironically, Sony made for the SNES. The music was just, you had to go with the Nintendo version. It was just that rendered high quality. I wish we actually could have like a sound clip comparison.
You have any opinions on what was the worst console ever, Maxim?
Not really. I mean, I never really played that much with consoles. So
old computer?
I did have a question though. Let me see what you guys' takes on that is. I've seen those, you know, those joysticks that have like all the C64s built into the joystick.
Yeah.
Have you tried one of those?
A console on the chip, yeah.
Right. Because I'm thinking of getting one of those just for nostalgia reasons. Do you like them?
Supposedly, they're really cool. And from what I understand, they're actually really hackable in the sense that you can hook up a lot of the old peripherals to
that's
it.
That's the best. The best quality of them is you can just take them apart, put them in a cabinet, and attach controls to them, and you have a full emulator cabinet.
Well, my understanding, the person who made it, she herself. I would say was a hacker herself. Actually, she really went out of her way to demonstrate this.
And she's at Nauticon, actually.
Yeah, and she was also at Penny Arcade Expo. Mm. I saw her there, and I was actually rather impressed by that product. But it's not new because, like, now we have the Genesis with the Genesis and the Atari, and I think even like Coleco and Intellivision even have that now.
And going further with consoles, you can put those little tiny emulators in the stick inside of portable systems. You just attach a screen to them like Ben Heck is doing.
Right. Ben Heck is awesome. Like,
he has a big following now with his forums. People are making portable systems out of all old computers and game systems now.
It's funny, though. there's a great shift towards classic gaming. Like, for instance, my friend Brian, he's releasing a game called Retro City Rampage. There's a little plug for him there. And I actually remember him developing this game about 5 years ago, actually, for the NES itself. So he was actually writing the game specifically to be an NES ROM. Mm. And effectively what the game is a Grand Theft Auto clone, similar to Grand Theft Auto 1 and 2, which arguably was actually a lot better in a lot of ways.
Top-down and deep.
Top-down, it was a lot more fun, right? Yeah. So now he's releasing it for the Wii, and it'll look effectively like an 8-bit game. So it's kind of like with Mega Man 9, and I think Mega Man 10 is coming out now,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it's already come out.
Oh, it's already come out.
Yep.
Is it as hard as shit as Mega Man 9?
Yeah.
I have to say that it's probably the most frustrating Mega Man game I've ever played. Like,
what I love with the thing that they did with it also is that they actually have an option that, because it's a new engine, so it can actually run smooth, and they actually have an option to make it flashy and glitchy like it was on the NES with the early Mega Man games. I think that's the funniest option I've ever seen in a game.
If you want to do something really freaky with the NES, I don't know if the Super Nintendo has this problem so much, but with the NES, it used to be that you could actually, if you play in an emulator, you can actually see something coming before it actually just comes on the screen.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can do that with the Super Nintendo, but does Mega Man 10 have that option?
I don't know, but if they're going to make Mega Man 11, they should definitely include that.
that's a really easy way to cheat. I think that's how I got through Ninja Gaiden so many times, because Ninja Gaiden was like the... That had to be the hardest game of all of NES games.
And to note, because this is classic, we're not talking about the Tomoe Kagaki ones. We're talking about the 2D running around.
There was four for the NES?
Yeah, because now when you say Ninja Gaiden, we think of the, you know, the big boobed blood ones that are out now. So I just want to clarify that.
It's like Bionic Commando.
Right.
Bionic Commando got released, what was it, for the 360 or the PS3 or something like
that? Yeah, updated, and it just, it didn't work.
Who cares?
Right. And funny enough, Rearmed, which was the, like, homage to the 2D version with the side product, was actually the best seller. You know, so there you go with the, you know, people are reverting back a lot to arcade games. Actually, that's the thing. Why do you think people are reverting back to that, like, arcade set format, or getting reinterested in, like, arcade classic type games?
You know, from my personal experience, I have a really hard time with the new games navigating 3D space with a controller, and it burns a lot of cycles in my head. It's very tiring, and falling back to the old side-scrollers, and I play Super Mario Brothers at least once a month.
The Wii game?
No.
Have you played the Wii game yet?
The NES one. I don't have a Wii. I don't have access to emulate a Wii, so I have not. I have not played those. I'm looking forward to it, but I honestly recommend it.
It's
highly.
I got my chance when I was at PAX last summer. Play this game when it was just before it was released, and as soon as I started playing it, it basically solved all my problems. Because with the exception of Paper Mario, there hadn't been a proper 2D Mario game up until then. And we've been relying on playing Mario World, 100,000 times.
And what's interesting is that when you look at indie games, or if you saw E3 this year and Nintendo's E3, there's a huge resurgence of, even though they've done 3D, of 2D style games. And actually, Miyamoto has commented on that, and I agree, is that the thing is, those type of games, they were designed to be pick up and play. They're just easier for people to play. The only problem with it was that since most of them were ported arcade games, they were designed to be ass hard to get your money. So the whole thing was, now we've added the depth to it, I think. We've added more content. It's about the content rather than munching quarters, because when you're at home, you're not sticking quarters into your Wii console slot.
You're just eating power.
Yeah.
It's best to make a challenging and fun game now. I think it's... especially like first-person shooters and games like that, games with a long theme, big storyline you have to go in and complete, it just takes too much time. You know, you just want to sit down and waste some brain for a little while. Mm-hmm. And that's what the side-scrollers and the 2D games provide.
Well, that's like why I don't find MMOs very appealing. Like, I gave World of Warcraft a try for a while, and I just found it infuriating because, you know, you can drop and play, but there's all this goal you always have to constantly work towards. It's never-ending. Whereas when you play a platformer, you pick it up, you know, and you get bored after, you know, 15, 20 minutes, and you go do something productive after that. And I think that's the beauty of the platformer games. And, like, you know, that's even going maybe a little bit further, you look at Mario Kart. Mario Kart, it has a lot of ways to pick up and go game as well. And
yeah.
I'm kind of happy with the exception of the GameCube version. It's kept most of its form through all the years.
So we have Handler on the phone. I just don't know how to get him in.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know. I don't see him on the list here. I wouldn't mind having my buddy from Handler, are you from Kingston? I think he's from Kingston.
Should I refresh it?
Maybe. We'll just refresh this thing and see if he shows up on the list.
Go beat up the techies outside.
Yeah, let me go outside and beat him up.
Hit Command R. No, he's not showing up on that list.
Type cookie.
Portable consoles, though, that's actually one thing that has kind of gone boring. I remember getting a Game Boy for the first time, and you know it was two colors, and you know it was interesting. And I don't think it's really kept its funness. Like I think the iPhone has kind of killed it. But
yes and no. But you see a lot of people, especially here in New York City, on the subway playing with their DSs.
Yeah,
and it's the same idea. You just want something quick and mindless to play. Right. So they play Sudoku and they play those mind enhancing games.
I think it's more going towards casual gaming these days, and
And that's all you can really do is because you have so little time, you know, between everything you have going on in your life. You just have a few spare minutes. You want to take a
switch,
break,
play it.
And then you're playing a game, and then you're not playing a game.
That's why I'm very interested in to see how the 3DS is going to perform, which is what Nintendo recently announced.
The 3DS is kind of scary, but there is one. Somebody says Android's a new portable console.
that has to be proven.
The thing about the 3DS that actually kind of interested is that we actually have a sequel to Kid Icarus.
Right.
After all these years, because Kid Icarus kept appearing in Super Smash Brothers.
Well, Nintendo's whole announcement is that they're more shift. The idea is that with the DS, they got a lot of casual people, and so now they're updrafting. So with the 3DS, you're going to see a lot more established franchises and more quote-unquote hardcore gaming on that. What I think is interesting is because you know how you said 3D navigation, that's hard to do that. Apparently, with the otoscopic 3D, what they found is that it's a lot easier to do. That apparently having actual 3D as opposed to trying to emulate 3D on a screen frees up a lot of 3D gaming aspects. Like 2D will not go away, but like that apparently helps.
Trying to map your two thumbs to 3D space is just
impossible.
Takes way too much focus. Yeah.
No, the thing that's interesting about the 3DS is actually how it does the 3D. Apparently, it does like some sort of raised LCD pixel that has three phosphors. Yeah. I guess is what you call it.
I can explain that easy. It's from Sharp. They're also in their recent cameras. Basically, it divides the pixel lines in a certain layer way. So you have a bunch of row pixels. That's one image. And then it's opposite. Every row it's skipped is another image. And when you look at it, your eyes do what it normally does to an object. And so you see it's natural 3D.
But my understanding is you have to keep that still in order to see that effect. Whereas if you were actually, in any other environment other than actually at E3, you actually would have in your hand. And like if you're a person like me, I can't keep my hand still for that long.
Right.
It's not going to.
That's why they have the slider.
Oh, the slider?
Yeah, you can adjust the strength of the 3D, including completely turning it off.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Oh, that's perfect, because I probably would keep it off.
They really did think of everything with it. I think that's why I'm interested to see it perform, because they're going to go for more of a hardcore thing, so we'll have to see. Because, Sony tried to do the PSP, and it failed. And you know it failed because you see, PSPs, at the Nintendo World Store, but they're all actually running, Mario Kart 64 and things like that on it. It's all emulation.
That's actually the one thing I'm looking forward to with my trip to New York here, is I'm going to go finally check out Nintendo World. Used to be the Pokemon Center?
If you want, I can give you a tour because they're all friends of mine down there.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I'm probably going to be heading out there probably tomorrow evening, actually. This is definitely my first trip to New York, but it's also, let's put it this way, I'm probably in the doghouse for being away from my fiance for a week. So
you would, to get back classic gaming, you would love, they have a small museum. I've always told them that they need three floors and one floor just a museum, but they have this nice small museum. And what they have there is they have a Game Boy, and this is the parent backstory. Gulf War, Soldier had his Game Boy with a Tetris cartridge running. Yes, and it's actually there where they got firebombed. The tanks melted. I think around 12 people died. Besides that, melted so you can't use the buttons, it still runs. The only real damage in terms of the actual game is one pixel is off, but it's still running Tetris.
There's a lot of horror stories. I remember reading Nintendo Power as a kid and reading about one story where somebody left their Game Boy out in the middle of Alaska during the winter. And once the snow melted away, the Game Boy still worked after letting it dry out. It's like, Nintendo, these days it's not the same, but back in those days, those consoles could take a good beating.
Well, not as many discrete components were involved, and the processing tolerances have gotten sky high these
days. And I would also say they are the same if you also compare all the other hardware out there, because if you compare 3DS with PSP and iPhone, for example, if you chucked a Walkman at someone, they go into a coma and die. It was freaking heavy. It's like, if you throw an iPod at someone, the whole thing shatters and you've just wasted $500. Compared to all the electronic devices.
We have a call.
Yeah, the parking system wasn't working, but they're just going to patch the collars right in. So.
Oh, they oh, yeah. go ahead and patch them
so
in.
So we have a collar now? Handler?
Apparently.
Who's on the line? Hello?
Hello?
Speak up, please.
Handler?
This is just like WBAI, I think.
Yeah. Come on, you're on off the hook. Speak up.
That's yeah, talking to NYC 555.
Well, I hear a hum. Somebody speak up. Somebody's speaking. See, even Radio Statler saying on IRC, speak up.
We have dead air. We have dead air.
Do something. Play the promo.
Well, while I'm waiting, I'm going to go play Dr. Mario here. Actually, prior to this, I was kind of bored, so I started playing Dr. Mario. And
I play that every day.
Yeah.
You know what? I think Tetris and Dr. Mario were the two games of the 80s and early 90s that really were the first casual games. Like, my mother played Tetris one time until 4 in the morning on me without realizing it. And my fiance's mother, she plays Dr. Mario even to this day.
I have a funny story on that. I was interested in the first Game Boy, and I bought it. And then my grandma got interested in it, and she played Tetris and other games so much on it that she eventually got her own. With their own sticker on it. And one time, because we had a dedicated sewing room, and so we're looking in there, and she's by the sewing machine, so we think that she's working on a project. My mom checks in 10 years later, she was actually playing Tetris on, like, she was like at like the like 50th mark line, and so she's like, stop playing Tetris, you need to eat. No, I have to keep going on. And there was just something magical about that. That, yeah.
What is the highest level you guys have gone in Dr. Mario Tetris?
Tetris is 75.
Well,
where basically you blink and it's in.
We don't want to talk about DS Tetris, because DS Tetris I've gone to ridiculous levels.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. I don't have the patience to make it all the way up to the highest levels anymore, but two player Dr. Mario, I can really kick some ass. I probably could challenge
you. Do you have a USB controller with you?
It's at home, unfortunately.
Oh, damn. Now, that's actually, I would have to say, the highest level I've ever achieved in Dr. Mario would be 16. And that was one of these nights that I think it's just one of those wasted nights. You know, like, you know how today we all go through our wasted nights consist of, hey, how far can we get, how deep can we go through Wikipedia? Well, back in the 90s, is how far, how long can you keep playing Tetris or Dr. Mario? And yeah, Dr. Mario, I played until like 16 or something. Tetris was actually a lot harder to get above 10.
Yeah, I was never a big fan of Tetris, I think just because I wasn't as good at it. But Dr. Mario is
and Tetris is interesting because it has its own subculture of, and most of the subculture is competition. Like, there's just whole things of just competition in Tetris. Like, they have programs that specific design, like, kind of like how, like, certain games today are designed, like, first-person shooters to be competitive. They actually have that for Tetris in, like, you know, you can download clients and stuff. Yeah, Tetranets.
My friend runs a Tetranet network, actually. Mm. It's kind of interesting. Now, Maxim, there's some comments on IRC about the Game Boy and Tetris as well, actually. Earl Grey had something to say there.
I didn't catch
that. Oh, you didn't catch that?
No, because I was... I was trying to mention that, I guess, the phone system, it's not going to happen, which...
Oh, okay.
It's not bad, but... Well,
sorry.
Sorry, everybody. Who
blame Neo Amsterdam.
Earl Grey had a comment to say. He had a funny story about his Game Boy. His dad took his Game Boy... his Game Boy. He took his Game Boy away from the play Tetris, and he took it in the kitchen so no one would steal his go on Tetris. Opened the cupboard, and a tin of tomatoes fell out of the cupboard and smashed the screen. Now, my question for you, Earl Grey, is: does the Game Boy still work?
Yeah.
And the other comment that was made here by Bonnery Warrior is: Tetris and Dr. Mario were the gateway drug for the current senior citizen epidemic, aka Farmville. You know. When I look at
Seniors play Farmville? Because usually most people I know who play Farmville are actually around my age.
I thought most seniors these days, when it comes to playing video games, play Wii Bowling or whatever.
Use dedicated machines as opposed to just online general stuff. That's my experience with it.
Oh, he got an Atari Lynx as a replacement. Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I don't know if I would take that as a replacement. Like, the Atari Lynx was kind of cool, but it wasn't really that great.
You had to buy a suitcase, carry around with it. It wasn't... I mean, the original Game Boy, when we look back, wasn't portable. That thing really was not portable.
No, you're thinking of the Game Gear. The Atari Lynx was a little bit thinner than a... it was about the same size of a PSP, if I remember correctly.
Okay, I remember it being really wide.
It was really wide, but it was about the same. I think it was the same thickness as a PSP.
Hmm.
I think the worst portable console actually was probably the Nomad.
I agree. Yeah,
the Nomad was a cool concept.
Yeah, except that you turned it on and the game's last 5 seconds because that's like 8D batteries gone.
Well, and I guess if you had like some sort of, you know, like some sort of stocks and you know, Energizer or Duracell back then, yeah. I guess, you know, it worked in your favor to keep buying batteries all the bloody time.
Well, it had an AC adapter too, but at that point you're kind of like, what's the point?
And you can plug the thing into a TV apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny that the PSP, it's like, ooh, you can plug in a TV, this is new. No, we've done this before.
Game Gear wasn't that bad, though. You can actually get Game Gears pretty cheaply. Like, they're effectively a Sega Master System that's actually portable. So a lot of the games that were on the Master System were actually ported to the Game Gear in the end. And you can get... there's a lot of two-button fighter games that actually existed. Like Mortal Kombat was
Mortal Kombat 2, and it looked really good. The sprites were huge.
The sounds were actually it sounded okay. Like that was the impressive thing.
And speaking of Master System real quick, have you heard like the Master System stuff that happened in Brazil?
Yeah, I heard it was really
it's insane.
Huge
They even had the last version that came out, it had a trackball, the two buttons, and it was wireless. It like wireless, you put the plug in the back and that way you didn't have AV cables on. Like that's how much they loved it.
They
even ported Duke Nukem 3D to it.
Now, my understanding, the reason why the Master System was so huge was due to import laws that Brazil had, like some sort of competition law, because I think that was the same reason why the Apple II was never that big in Brazil in the first place, because... the Apple II was big in Brazil because somebody managed to actually clone this thing in the first place.
It's similar to Russia with the Dendi, which is NES.
I know we have a guy from Brazil on the IRC channel. Maybe he knows something about that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he's listening.
If you have that, speak up.
I think China is interesting, though, because Nintendo released
the IQ,
which was the N64. IQ, but I don't think it actually had a cartridge slot. The games were built in.
Now, what it is that it does have a cartridge, but it's almost like a... Remember like the Hue chips from TurboGrafx-16?
Yeah.
It sort of kind of works like that, where you take it and you go to a kiosk, it puts it on there, and that's because that's how they verify it, because all the piracy.
The Hue card was really weird to me, because if you collect consoles, you eventually start collecting imports, because there's a lot of import games out there that are just fucking
especially if you own a Sega Saturn.
Or a Sega Saturn, because if you own a Sega Saturn, if you want the games cheaper, buy the imports. Like Panzer Dragoon in North America, the North American version is expensive.
Or Deep Fear or Radiant Silver Gun,
exactly. And if you import the Japanese version, you don't need to know much Japanese, you know, but you can play these games without knowing any, and they're a fraction of what they cost. But going back to it, import adapters are really fucking weird. The Hue card was interesting because the TurboGrafx-16 was otherwise known as the PC Engine back in Japan. And the games were effectively the same.
Right.
But except the pins were pin 14 and pin 22 or something like that were reversed. So you had to get this huge adapter that would actually stick out of it. It was like this orange little adapter. It would go in like a Hue card. And you put your card in, flipped upside down or something like that. And you would plug in the games that way.
Well, you know, in terms of design, TurboGrafx to me was notorious for having ridiculous huge things for no reason. Like the back part was just aesthetics. If you took that off, you have a 30% reduced sized console. You know?
The
CD attachment was like...
the CD attachment.
It looked like a toilet.
No, here's the thing. The CD attachment for the PC Engine was the weirdest thing, because you actually had to plug the device into the back of your console. So you have this huge giant tumor on the back of the console. Like, I don't know what's worse, that or the Atari Jaguar CD, which actually looked like a fucking toilet, right? Going back to imports, actually, as Alcaset said here, RAM of fighting game imports were great for the Super Famicom. I actually agree. I think I've had the most success finding good games import-wise for the Super Nintendo. And that is the easiest console to get any import game. Like, the NES was a pain in the ass, and you required an adapter for the N64. But for the Super Nintendo, you just went in there. You could take... I don't recommend taking a soldering iron, but you could take a soldering iron, remove the plastic clips, or take, like, a plier if you wanted to risk cracking the plastic.
Right.
And, you'd be able to pop in any Super Famicom game, it'll work. I actually had the adapter, so I didn't have to do that, but it didn't work with Super FX games or anything like that. Dark Nemesis asked about Game Genies. I actually only had one, and it was for the NES. I've never actually really used cheat devices.
I only had one, and that was for the Genesis, and I used it mainly for Sonic's debug mode than anything, and like making a level just entirely out of rings. But Yeah, Game Genie. It's interesting because the Nintendo sued. I did that. I had a Homebrew versus Piracy talk here, and Nintendo sued them.
That's
because
right.
The thing is, which you said later, that there's a bunch of import stuff and you could do illegals. They had to bypass system, or basically, like, particularly this NES, Super NES, you just had you have a chip that does verification.
Yep.
So you do is it's like if anyone has a Sonic 3 and Knuckles, this is where they got that from, where you stack the game on top and it goes through the game to go to the real game you put on top of it, and that's the verification. But when it loads the data down from that game, it kills that data and then loads its own data in. So
yeah,
that's the cluckling method.
That is actually, there's only one game for the Super Nintendo that does that.
Yeah,
and that
horrible
is,
game.
It's Super Noah's Ark 3D, which I actually own.
Yeah.
I actually went out of my way looking for this thing because, it's a Christian game, and I don't give a shit about these sort of games, although the Christian games are kind of amusing.
I know.
But the funny thing is that, you put the game in there and you pop it on top, and it was built on the Wolfenstein engine, which is really fucking weird.
I heard that the reason why
is because it was pissed.
Yeah, because it was pissed because they got edited by Nintendo at the time. So,
and Handler, I actually have tried two Game Genies connected to each other, and it does work, but it doesn't. But I don't think the games actually will load because I actually tried it and it loaded, and then it would go to the next Game Genie, but then it wouldn't load the game. So you don't definitely stack it. Although, funny thing is that the Genesis could be the only console that really has anything stackable. There is actually an image floating around the internet of how many adapters can you put
on top of it.
There's
Leaning Tower of, like, it's like Game Genie, Sonic and Knuckles, the sort of like pass through like Master System emulator, another Game Genie, and it's like I think you can stack, I think 8 or 9 before it will lean over and plop.
Yeah.
So I know nothing about those, right? So for the ignorant, how do they work? You just plug them in and then you put the other.
It's stacked on top. So it's.
Right.
I think it was daisy.
What it
chaining.
Does is that, like, anyone out there, because it's way easy now, like, who has, like, an hex editor and you edit hex values to adjust programs, that's basically what it did, except since we're using cartridges, this was done through chips, so you actually had to interface them rather than just load the program next to the system.
It's funny with Sonic 1, actually, we're going back to Sonic and Knuckles. Sonic 1 could not do Sonic and Knuckles simply due to some sort of problem with the power.
Sonic
2 and Sonic 3. Well, Sonic 3 was developed with that in mind, and Sonic 2 was just was barely made it right. But Sonic 1 was supposed to be included with Sonic and Knuckles.
The sprites were in different dimensions.
Exactly, everything just all screwed up. It looks like we might have a caller. Maybe they might be able to get him on the air. Hopefully,
we're very lonely.
There was actually a Handler. There was a Game Boy adapter for the NES. There was actually two.
The Super.
There was
Game
two
Boy,
of them, actually. Yeah. There was one that did Game Boy Color.
Yeah.
And I actually have the original one. I don't have the Game Boy Color version, but it was actually it was really cool because in some games you actually got a Super Nintendo game with it, like Space Invaders had a full 16-bit game built right into it. You pop it in, and you would have two choices: to play the NES version or you played the Super Nintendo one.
Mm.
The Super Nintendo I think the Super Nintendo had been the coolest console. Like Genesis had a lot of cool stuff. But in Japan, you could do a lot of stuff with the Super Nintendo.
Well, if I may go on like a tangent to my favorite thing that I wish was in the U.S. Some of you remember a similar thing for the Genesis, which was called the Sega Channel, which basically was sort of a cable bootleg modem thing before we really knew what modems were. Well, in Japan, they had this thing called the Saddle View, where if you look under actually your Nintendo, they wanted to bring that over. Most Nintendo's consoles have little things where you can tell they're going to add something to it. And for all both the Japanese and the American ones, but only Japanese had this. You sat this thing on top. It connected to your satellite provider, so you got two things.
PSX.
You could do rankings. You can do simple online stuff. Or what's interesting is enchanting games. So like you would have like RPGs where they could actually do voice over the radio and real music, as opposed to like bleeps. Even though the sound card was powerful, but like almost CD quality music, they would stream through it. But what was interesting is you could only play it at certain times of the day because of the satellite system.
It's funny, that system ran until, I think, not too long ago. I think it was like 2007, but Japan had a lot of the coolest stuff because like you could actually get flash cartridges for the Game Boy and the Super Nintendo, and I think the N64 as well, up until recently. And the main reason for that is actually in Japan it's illegal to rent out video games and movies, so there's no rental industry there. So what Nintendo did, and this is the reason why the Famicom Disk System probably exists as well, is you would go to like 7-Eleven or Family Mart is another big chain there. You bring your cartridge, you bring your disc or whatever, you pop it into the system, you put in whatever yen that you have to put into there, and you would get a game.
Yeah.
And It was awesome.
And you could rewrite them, and actually that helped populate the NES, because there's a lot of people, which is now the Newtown philosophy, that you know, a lot of people can't spend that much money on things. So, like, so many people I know in Japan had one disc for that Family Famicom disc system, because they can just keep, like, you know, erase Metroid, put Zelda on it, and just use the same disc over and over again. Each game was then $5 instead of paying for the cartridge for it, which then it turns out like $30, $50, $80.
And there was a lot of cool things about the Famicom disc system that didn't exist in the Famicom itself, and that was actually it did FM synthesis. So if you were to play, say, something like Zelda, Castlevania, Metroid, those games sounded superior by many of our accounts. Like, if you go on YouTube and you pull up, do search for Metroid Japan or Castlevania Japan, the music is just
the
awesome.
Extra channel alone just helps.
Oh, it
and
does.
Then the sound quality just really. And what's also interesting in Japan too is that they had a full on basic system for it, kind of like how if you bought PS2, you might remember that you could actually get Linux for it with a bunch of updates. In Japan, you could actually get, so you could turn the Famicom into a true basic system, like kind of the ones we have at the retro show here.
And I have to say, though, Nintendo probably was really the best company, and I'm so glad they never brought out the PlayStation add-on for the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, I'm actually glad it spun.
But the whole story behind that's funny, because it was the Philips CD-i and the PlayStation are both products that came out of the Super Nintendo itself. But it's really funny, because Philips was the only company that managed to keep any licenses for us, so we ended up with that shitty Mario game and those three shitty Zelda games for it.
On the flip side, which is one of the problems, because the thing is, it's a really long story, but a lot of people only hear one side of it, which is that, Nintendo contracted both Sony and Philips and then announced at CES that they were going with Philips when Sony just made an announcement. The part that they miss out was that the reason why Nintendo did that was that Sony put this evil loophole, like, 5 pages into the contract. Basically, any game that they would run on that add-on, they would now own the properties for. So if they made a Mario for their CD add-on, Sony would then own Mario.
Yeah.
So even though we came out with those shitty games, you know, we could have had all of our Nintendo franchises go by.
Okay. So,
sorry,
looks like we're being told that we're out of time here.
Damn it!
I'd like to thank everybody for listening in, and I guess that's... Oh, sorry, what's that?
3 more minutes.
Oh, you got three minutes. Okay. Yeah. So I guess we should probably close this off with something.
Yeah.
Maybe we should, I don't know, maybe we should tell the reason why Sega doesn't do hardware anymore as a closing remark.
Sure.
You want me to tell the story?
Yeah.
All right. So this is actually, this is my favorite story about the whole video game market of the 90s. Mm. And Sega and Nintendo was always going at in terms of graphics. So you have like, Sega does what Nintendo don't. Which is, I remember that ad so well. And
aggressive marketing.
It was very aggressive.
Because it's the idea is to target the older brothers, and then the younger brothers would start playing.
Exactly. So, but the thing is, though, Nintendo, with the exception of the... Sega just thought, okay, we got to push graphics. We got to make these games awesome. We got to make them look pretty. So, when they announced the Sega Saturn was announced, what, in 93, 94, something like that? And it was released in 96, but... 2 years after the PlayStation. But what had happened was Sega decided 6 months prior to release the 32X.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a very limited library of games. The games were... I don't think any of the games existed outside of North America.
Mm-hmm.
But then Sega went out and announced that they were going to release another Genesis, which had the 32X built in. The Neptune, that's right. And it's rumored that it was actually finished, and there's a whole shitload of them somewhere. But then they released the Saturn... 6 months after the release of 32X, the Saturn sales lagged, but shortly after the Saturn's release, Sega goes out and says, oh, we're going to release another console in 3 years. So it's 96, 99 is when the Dreamcast came out. So in Japan, it worked out fine because the Saturn always did better than the PlayStation in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But in North America, because everyone got boned on the 32X... Right.
Especially the investors.
there was no faith in Sega of America. So it's actually Sega of America's fault for not having any hardware anymore. Like, there's still Sega arcade hardware out there.
Right.
But we don't see anything from Sega in terms of consoles anymore.
And the other quick interesting thing is that if you owned an original gigantic Xbox, you might notice that there's a lot of similarities between it and the Dreamcast, like the built-in modem, the shape of the controller. Sega's contract with Microsoft was that we were going to help you make your console, like its design, if can run Dreamcast games and our games on it. Of course, Microsoft did that tricky thing where they let them build the console, but then terminated that part of the contract. So technically, Sega got absorbed that hardware division into Microsoft.
But it is the spiritual successor to the Dreamcast.
Yeah.
With that said, 30 seconds. So yes. With that said, I would have to say though the last good the Dreamcast was the best console that Sega put out after the Saturn. So since we'll be just going off the air now, I'd like to thank you all for listening in once again, and I'd like to say thank you to Maxim.
Well, thanks for having me here.
You're welcome.
Rodents ran off to go get his girlfriend and Adios Mio. Oh my gosh! So
I'll get drunk.
So yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thanks guys.
Thank you guys.